Is academic freedom under attack in American colleges and universities?
Academic freedom has been at the center of much of the controversy in higher education.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about academic freedom and how it's not the same as freedom of speech. We'll also hear about a student economic tour of Asia and spend an academic minute bemoaning the pay gap between men and women. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Academic freedom is crucial to the health of the American higher education system and is under attack on many fronts. That's the opening premise of Henry Reichman's new book called The Future of Academic Freedom. Dr. Reichman is the chair of the American Association of University Professors Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure and is professor emeritus of history at California State University, East Bay. We started out with the big question, what is academic freedom?
Well, academic freedom has actually since 1915 been defined by the American Association of University Professors, and that's the definition that is widely accepted throughout academia, to involve three basic things. First is the freedom of professors to teach their subject in the classroom. And when I say to teach their subject, I mean they're not free to teach whatever the heck they want. I mean, if you're assigned to teach a mathematics class, you can't turn around and say, well, we're going to discuss politics all the time in this class and learn the mathematics on your own. That's not academic freedom. But in teaching your subject, you have the freedom to use your professional discipline to determine what books you're going to assign, how you're going to grade, what standards you will use, what approaches you will use, etc. And also should be free that the statements you may make in the classroom are confidential and private, are not intended for the general public. Second element is freedom in research, which is the freedom to choose your own topics and research and pursue them according to the standards of your discipline and to control the results of your research, which is actually the one area that has been most kind of threatened in recent years and under research, which is a number of universities are now requiring faculty members to sign over rights to anything they produce that might be patentable in advance to the university as if it was a work made for hire. And that runs counter to the whole tradition of academic freedom in the United States. To be sure, faculty members are free and should be free to make arrangements at the university. If the university is putting significant financial resources into some research, that the university will get a share of it, but that should be in a contract agreeable to both sides. And finally, the third element of academic freedom, and probably the area that's most controversial, is what we have come to call the freedom of extramural expression, which literally means expression outside the walls of the university, although it doesn't really mean the physical walls. It means really outside the employment relationship. And that is the freedom to speak as a citizen of the institution and of the broader society on subjects of controversy. And we hold as well that that freedom extends not only to the professor's own area of expertise, but to other areas, precisely because, take for example, a physics professor with controversial ideas about the economy, if he speaks on the economy and says something that maybe most of us think is rather foolish, but he could absolutely be a brilliant physicist, and you don't want him threatened for that. So those are the basic elements of academic freedom. The AAUP and other scholars have, of course, elaborated on these extensively over the years, and, of course, it takes me some almost 300 pages to do it. So
yes, exactly. And we're just talking about higher education. K through 12 is pretty rigid when it comes to what people are going to teach, right?
Yes, our understanding of academic freedom comes from higher education. I think there is an argument to be made that K-12 teachers should have some version of academic freedom, but I could understand it would likely be more limited than what is available to people in higher ed, but that's not our concern. So.
As you see it, where are the attacks on academic freedom coming? Well, first of all, what are the attacks, and where are they coming from, inside or outside the institution, both? Where are they coming?
Well, I think the answer is both. The most visible attacks are the kind of things that make the headlines where a faculty member, and it's often around that third element of extramural expression, but sometimes it's something said in the classroom. A faculty member says or writes something that some individual or group finds offensive, and they mount an attack online and social media. They call on the institution to fire the professor. Often that faculty member may receive death threats or even worse. And that is a major element. It happens far more frequently than we would like, but it's the real danger is not even in the actual incidents, but in the chilling effect it has on everybody else. The fear of like, well, I better not say anything controversial because, you know, I might, you know, there but for the grace of God go I might be the victim. Those are the most subtle, but I actually think a bigger threat to academic freedom comes from inside the institutions, and that is the increasing reliance over the last 30 or so years of reliance on the employment of non-tenure track faculty members, often part-time, usually very poorly paid with little job security, instead of hiring people on the tenure track. I mean, according to our statistics at this point, as many as 3/4 of all those people teaching in higher ed today are not only not tenured, they don't even have access to future tenure. That is very troubling, not because tenure is some great perk or is, as some people wrongly believe, a guarantee of lifetime employment no matter how much you screw up, but because tenure was designed as the biggest, strongest protection for academic freedom. A faculty member who can be simply not, you don't have to be fired, just simply non-renewed because of something he or she said, is going to be very restricted in their ability to try new things in the classroom, to teach iconoclastic ideas, or to pursue dangerous avenues of research or speak out in public. So I think that is actually the single largest threat to academic freedom today.
Have the attacks on tenure been, well, I'm sure they have been increasing, especially recently?
Well, yes, they have. And there's been a few bills in some state legislatures to eliminate tenure in the system. But to be honest, those kind of what we might call frontal assaults on tenure have not been very successful. And there's no real sign they're going to be more successful now. And sadly, I think the reason for that is because it turned out to be much easier to undermine tenure by simply not providing the resources to institutions to hire full-time tenured faculty. And as I was saying, this increased reliance on part-time faculty, what some people have called the adjunctification of higher education, has been far more effective at undermining the tenure system and hence undermining academic freedom than the kind of frontal assaults we occasionally find from legislators or others.
Do these attacks give more power to your union, or do they make you more dependent on your union?
Well, those faculty members who are fortunate enough to have a union, we hope that they will get protections for academic freedom in their contracts. But in fact, ever since 1980, the Supreme Court ruled in the Yeshiva University case that tenured and tenure track faculty members at four-year universities are, under the National Labor Relations Act, managers, and therefore not eligible to unionize. And so while anyone could join a union to actually have a union contract, it's almost impossible to do without working through the NLRB, at least in the private sector. In the public sector, of course, states can provide enabling legislation, and some states have, notably that New York and California have strong legislation that led to strong faculty unions. But the majority of faculty members are not represented by a union and do not have the right. I think only about 20% of faculty nationwide are represented by a union. The other aspect of this with respect to unions is that with the creation of what some have called this two-tier system of one group of tenure track faculty, the other group of people on these contingent contracts in which they can often be laid off, you know, in a moment's notice. It creates a tension between those two groups, which is sometimes played out in questions of union representation. We in the AAUP believe that the best union is one that brings both groups together and works out whatever differences there may be within the ranks of the employees. But in some states, the law requires two different unions. And in the private sector, if tenured and tenure track faculty members are not allowed to unionize, the adjuncts have to go it alone, so to speak.
Still to come, our conversation with Professor Henry Reichman continues with a look at the difference between academic freedom and freedom of speech. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Henry Reichman, the chair of the American Association of University Professors Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure. He's professor emeritus of history at California State University, East Bay. We're talking about his new book called The Future of Academic Freedom. In his book, Professor Reichman talks about the difference between academic freedom and freedom of speech.
Well, when you think about the classic image for freedom of speech is the free marketplace of ideas, where any idea goes. And while I think that's an important value for universities, at least for the students and the community in the university, it certainly doesn't apply in the classroom. Let me give an example. Anti-vaxxers, people who claim that vaccinations cause autism, et cetera, have the right to propagate their ideas. And should an anti-vaxxer speaker be invited to a campus by some group, the campus, I think, is obliged to let that person speak. However, I don't think anyone in his right mind would really want an anti-vaxxer teaching in our medical schools. Similarly, astrology. One can advocate astrology. Indeed, I'm sure there are student newspapers around the country where there are campus newspapers where there are astrology columns. But if an astronomy professor were to start professing that astrology is true, I don't think he would be protected by academic freedom. I think his colleagues would have good reason to call into question his right to teach that. So there is that difference. In a certain, to sum it up very quickly, freedom of speech is a democratic value. Academic freedom is a meritocratic value. It's something that is earned in a discipline, that you have the right to academic freedom because you're a specialist and an expert in your field. Having said all that, I want to stress that I think it's very hard to imagine a university where freedom of speech is limited and academic freedom is healthy, or vice versa. I think the two go closely together. The rights of students to speak out, the rights of visiting campus speakers to speak out, even if their ideas run counter to what the academy believes, need to be protected on campuses in order to ensure ultimately that academic freedom as well is protected.
Well, so far we've been talking about this from the viewpoint of the professors and the teachers and the faculty. What about the students? How does this freedom and the attacks on it affect their day-to-day student life?
Well, back in 1915, when the AAUP first defined academic freedom, they used a concept they picked up from Germany, where in the late 19th century, a lot of American academics got their start. And that was the difference between what they called Lehrfreiheit and Lernfreiheit. Lehrfreiheit is the freedom to teach. Lernfreiheit is the freedom to learn. The students have the freedom to learn. And I think the freedom to teach and the freedom to learn are obviously closely connected. If professors do not have the freedom to teach, students' freedom to learn will be limited. And so anything that intimidates or limits the ability of faculty members to speak out, to teach as their subject as they see fit, ultimately affects students. Also, I want to say that I think student rights are extremely important. Students have the right, by the way, to disagree with their faculty members, as well as they often do, to criticize them. That's part of the freedom to learn, in fact. So and back in 1967, the AAUP and a number of other organizations, including the United States Student Association, adopted a document, Statement of Principles on the Rights and Freedoms of Students. And now, more than 50 years later, you read that document, and every word of it seems applicable today. So I think students very much have a stake in protecting their own freedom of speech and also the academic freedom of their faculty.
You do talk in the book about there is more censorship of student journalism going on right now than there has been in the past.
Yes, I think that's a very troubling problem. Too often now, student newspapers, et cetera, are being treated as if they should be publicity organs for the institution rather than real journalism. And I think that clearly the reason to have student newspapers or a student radio station or things like that is to provide students, particularly journalism students, but often students in other majors, the experience of trying to be real journalists, to do the work. And to do that, they have to have the rights and freedoms of real journalists. And unfortunately, that's become a real problem. The AAUP, along with the College Media Association, the Student Press Law Center, and the National Coalition Against Censorship, issued a report on this a couple of years ago, which I mentioned several times in the book. I was privileged to be one of the authors of that report. And it's a very troubling development that I think really does not get the attention it deserves. I mean, people who complain about a free speech crisis on campus because a handful of conservative speakers are shouted down, and let me make clear, they shouldn't be, but ignore the fact that student journalists are being treated in ways that journalists are being treated in authoritarian countries.
The first generation of students born after 9/11 are going to be entering college this year. Have they grown up with so much security consciousness that they're not as passionate about the freedom of speech?
I hope not. I've always been rather skeptical about generational generalizations, because when I taught, I mean, I'm retired now, but in all the years that I taught, I always had some students who were very absorbed with politics from multiple perspectives. I have others that were very conservative and sort of didn't want anything to do with politics. It's always the case. I'm certain, of course, that the students who are coming into school today are more concerned with issues of security than certainly I was back in the 1960s. But at the same time, they're also concerned with some other things, like the tremendous growth of student debt, which is really burdensome on students and which restricts their opportunities. So I've always remained optimistic about students. I think they always have the potential to grow and learn. That's why they're there. And I'm looking forward to seeing that. Well, as I'm retired, I won't see him directly, but I always think a new generation of students will always bring something new and exciting to the campus.
Well, speaking about not seeing students directly brings me to this last note I have here, which is about technology and online learning. Does this apply to online courses? And there are some students who never walk into a campus.
Well, yes, I think we've tried to make clear that academic freedom and its principles apply just as much to the electronic and other formats as they do personally. I mean, an example I've liked to give is administration has no more right to look at a faculty member's email than they have the right to go into his campus mailbox and open letters. But I think when it comes to learning in the classroom, online teaching, it's a complicated thing. I think generalizations don't really hold very well. To tell me that online teaching is good or bad is like telling me that the seminar or the lecture are good or bad. It depends upon the context, what subject, for whom, how many students, etc. I do believe that online teaching has increasingly been abused as a sort of cheapening way to provide education, and that is really troublesome. I do have a chapter in my book about this, claims that online teaching will allow us to offer, say, a Stanford education to everyone is just hype. Not realistic. So I'm concerned about it, but I wouldn't want to make any blanket condemnations or praises of online teaching, because a lot of it depends upon the situation. I will say this, though. When online teaching is done well, it's not so cheap.
Well, finally, looking ahead, are you hopeful?
Well, I'm an optimist by nature, so I am hopeful. But I will say that I think that academic freedom now is under as much assault in various ways, some of which we talked about in this conversation, to a degree not seen for quite some time. The opening essay in my book is called "Does Academic Freedom Have a Future?" And I end the essay by answering that question by saying, "It's up to us." And I think that's, I hope, the lesson of my book, that it's up to us, by which I mean, first and foremost, my fellow faculty members, but really I mean the entire society, that if we are going to sustain the kind of open, free, and productive higher education system that we have built in this country in the 20th century, if we're going to sustain that, we really have to renew our commitment to academic freedom, not only as a faculty, but as a society.
Again, the name of Dr. Henry Reichman's new book is The Future of Academic Freedom. It's published by Johns Hopkins Press. Some students from Montreal have returned from a tour of small and large economic hubs in Asia. This is the 11th year McGill University students have traveled to global economic centers and emerging markets. This year, the students, alumni, and professors traveled to Japan and Thailand to study business trends in the Far East. The best of our knowledge's Pat Bradley reports.
About 30 people from disciplines including business, law, the arts, engineering, and medicine joined the Desitel Faculty of Management's Hot Cities Tour to Tokyo, Bangkok, Hong Kong, and Wahin, a coastal island in Thailand known for its tourism. Associate Professor Carl Moore leads the group and explains why this year's circuit was chosen.
The trip is taking the future to the future, that is young people, to where the world economy is experiencing considerable growth. Now, Tokyo is one of the great cities of the world. Because of a lack of immigration and an aging population, it's perhaps sliding back a little bit vis-a-vis China, but it is still one of the great cities of the world. Bangkok and Thailand was chosen because of it's an emerging country with considerable growth rates, and went to Hong Kong for a day and a bit because we just can't fly from Bangkok straight back to Montreal, and so decided to spend a day and a bit and meet some very interesting people.
The participants met with corporate and legislative leaders, including executives from Bombardier Asia, Shopify, Deutsche Bank, Walmart, and L'Oreal. They discussed ecotourism with Wildlife Friends Foundation Thailand and met with social media executives. Management senior Kenza Bennis is a double major in finance and accounting. She says while economic concepts can be taught in a classroom, the trip is invaluable.
What is valuable to see them in this context is that you can relate them to the experiential learning that you do in the trip. And so it was just quite interesting to see how global competitiveness is affecting Tokyo, or how thinking global versus local is applied in all of these countries. And just talking to like the CEOs and all of the people we had the chance to talk to and make these links.
Bennis is from Casablanca, Morocco. She is at McGill in Montreal, Canada, because she wanted to study at a prestigious international university. This is the first time she traveled to Asia.
One thing that struck me, especially in Thailand, is that I see a lot of similarities with Morocco. I see how the economy is evolving. I see how they're in need of leaders that have this local understanding of the country, but also a global aspect, because it's new issues that they're facing and they need people to make things move.
Moore says the Hot Cities Tour returns to Asia frequently because much of the world's economic growth is occurring there.
Europe is somewhat in decline. The U.S. is the world's greatest economy, and Canada is very much involved with that. But the future is to a considerable degree in Asia. Therefore, the U.S. must continue to develop those relationships. China particularly is not a shrinking violet. They are the only country that's been important throughout human history. The U.S. must come to terms with Asia because Asia is the future to a considerable degree for the world economy.
Bennis adds that as a perspective manager in a global economy, it's critical to consider the Asian perspective on business and finance.
It's quite important to be able to distinguish, like, what global expertise are you bringing versus what local responsiveness you must have. And so being able to experience it there and to learn about how the ways they do business there is ultimately a very good experience to build this kind of knowledge.
Past Hot Cities of the World tours have included trips to Singapore, Malaysia, Manila, Jakarta, Bali, Mongolia, South Korea, and India. Reporting for The Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Pat Bradley.
Just because most people understand that there is a pay gap between men and women doesn't necessarily mean they're going to do anything about it. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
The wage gap is still wide open. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Michelle Gilman, professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, examines the reasons why.
Women who work full-time and year-round earn about 80 cents to every dollar earned by men. The gap is even starker for women of color. What causes the gap, and why hasn't it budged for the last 15 years? To begin with, men and women are steered into different occupations, and male-dominated fields pay more for comparable work. Also, women bear larger responsibility for child-rearing. The United States is the only developed nation without paid maternity leave, and families struggle to find affordable childcare. Further, economists have found that gender-based discrimination feeds as much as one-third of the gap. Unfortunately, existing federal fair pay laws have not closed the gap. This is partly because courts accept almost any business-related defense raised by employers. So, for example, an employer can justify lower pay for a woman based on her prior salary. 10 years ago, President Obama signed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act into law, giving women more time to file unequal pay lawsuits. This is important because salary discussions are typically taboo in the American workplace, making it hard for a woman to know she is being paid less. But this act alone cannot close the gap. Accordingly, fair pay advocates support passage of the proposed Paycheck Fairness Act, which would encourage greater pay transparency, ban employers from asking about salary history, and make it easier to prove discrimination. Unwilling to wait, many states are passing their own, stronger fair pay laws, and some private employers are auditing and remedying their own gender pay disparities. These steps may start to close the gender pay gap.
That was Michelle Gilman of the University of Baltimore School of Law. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.